And finally, early in the 21st century, additional democracies were established, usually through peaceful but well-organized protest in places like Ukraine, Georgia, Indonesia, and elsewhere. This was, as I said already, by the early 21st century, this was the most extensive incidence of democratic politics the world had ever seen up to that point. Causes are at least in one sense fairly easy to determine. The spread of democracy was certainly encouraged by the Western powers and to some degree also Japan and India. There was a clear desire to see democracy established in additional parts of the world, partly in the first instance because of Cold War competitions, partly because of a genuine ideological commitment to democracy as the fairest and preferred political form. The spread of democracy in Latin America in the late 1970s owed a good bit, actually, to the impulse of United States foreign policy under President Carter, who probably gets less credit than he should for at least one successful move that had deep implications for human rights defense and the spread of democratic systems, particularly in the Americas. So, Western sponsorship and encouragement, the larger popularity still of the Western political model. That is, the West seemed to be offering examples of successful societies. One badge of Westernness was by this point clearly well-established and well-functioning democratic political systems. And by the 1970s and 80s, the West was now sufficiently out of the game of defending imperialism and empire that different societies could emulate the West without having a sense necessarily that they were caving in to some sort of vestige of imperialist control. Democratic political systems spread also without question, because it was widely believed that there was a direct association between democracy and economic prosperity. Many Latin American systems converted because of a belief that with democracy would come an additional commitment to freer enterprise, a dismantling of some former state interventions in the economy, and the association seemed reasonably clear. Gorbachev's opening of the Russian political system obviously was directly tied to his deep commitment to economic reform of a system that had become economically moribund. So the association of democracy with economic change was a key part of the picture. And certainly by the time one gets to the later 1980s, partly because of what was going on in the Soviet Union, the failure, or at least the considerable failure, of the Marxist political alternative meant that people interested in political change had probably a smaller set of options available to them, and in this sense also, democracy could seem particularly attractive. Two issues remain as we cap this aspect of the contemporary period of world history by noting the unusual spread of democratic systems, but two issues. One, there remain key parts of the world in which this democratic surge has not, at least to date, taken hold. China is a key case in point. The Chinese decision in 1978 to introduce market reforms was a sincere and significant change in policy, but it was accompanied by an equally clear assertion that the authoritarian aspect of communist political rule should not budge. So China, and in its wake a few other societies, notably Vietnam, attempted the really interesting effort to introduce rapid economic development, rapid economic change, while holding the political landscape still. And thus far, though it required a major put-down of democratic protest in China in 1989, thus far this experiment seems to work. The Middle East is another region in which democracy remains the exception rather than the rule, although there are a few additional stirrings in the early 21st century, partly under American encouragement. Israel, at least for Israeli citizens, is a democratic beacon. It's important to remember also that although there were ups and downs in this process, by the late 20th century, Turkey was fairly firmly established in the camp of democratic countries in which democracy and reasonably free political expression seemed to have found durable base. But much of the Middle East remains anchored in one-party systems, in authoritarian rule, in monarchy. And while a certain amount of political discussion may be encouraged and there may be change in the offing, this is not a democratic bastion. And of course, there are still other parts of the world where exceptions need to be noted. What causes the exceptions and how deeply rooted are they? The two biggest exceptions to the democratic surge, China and many parts of the Middle East, raise interesting issues concerning the interaction between older traditions and more recent developments. China, for example, is historically a Confucian or Neo-Confucian society in which political interests ran strong, but democratic impulses were quite feeble. Confucianism and democracy do not readily mix, although they can ultimately reach some accommodation. At the same time, of course, China is also a society that experienced successful revolution reasonably recently. As we've established previously, revolution does not, immediately at least, lead to democratic competitive political systems. So China entertains an interesting combination of probably undemocratic traditional impulses combined with recent events that inhibit democracy as well. Something of the same balance may operate in the Middle East. Experts debate inconclusively the extent to which Islamic traditions may or may not be compatible with democratic political rule. So there may be a traditional element here that needs to be considered. But more obvious in this case particularly are more recent inhibitors. The fall of the Ottoman Empire early in the 20th century led to a whole series of new regimes, essentially new nations, particularly in the Middle East proper, where social divisions, questions about legitimacy, in some cases religious divisions, clashes between secular leaders and religious majorities, all of these factors, which are 20th century factors really, all of these factors inhibit democracy, at least to date, as is the case in other new nations instances in other societies and other periods as well. The second key question about the late 20th, early 21st century spread of democracy, the democratic gains in answering the question, we've thrown out the old political system, what will the new one be like? The other main question obviously involves durability. By the early 21st century, questions were developing about Russia's commitment to a really open democracy as apparently authoritarian impulses, efforts to squelch political opposition, gained increasing ascendancy amid Russian leadership. And in a few Latin American instances, questions remained current as well about whether a society that had not previously sustained long periods of democratic rule really would be able to sustain it now. Questions also involved concerns about the association between democracy and expectations of economic prosperity. This was an attractive combination, but what if it didn't work? How many societies could maintain democracy, particularly when it was still fairly new, amid frustration at economic stagnation or even economic decline? There were obviously questions. Other issues, however, might encourage greater optimism for democracy, even in additional regions in the future. As the use of computers spread, for example, although some regimes like China managed to put some clamps on computer access and access to freely available internet programs, experts did begin to wonder, with computers, with increasing difficulties of preventing access to new ideas and new forms of political expression, would there be a technological underpinning that would see democracy spread still further? We don't know the answer to these questions. We know the questions exist, and they exist because of the undeniable change in global political climate in the final decades of the 20th and early decades of the 21st century. The rise of democracy has certainly generated a number of speculations about the world's future. Some experts have waxed enthusiastic about prospects for democratic systems expanding everywhere. Some have urged that once democracy is the common form everywhere, wars will diminish because democracies do not engage in war against each other. These flights of optimism probably were at the very least overblown, but it's important to factor them in to our assessment of recent trends and prospects for the near future. What is clear, again, is that political change has been a key feature of the contemporary period of world history, that it has yielded unprecedented recent interest in democratic political forms. But finally, and this against oversimple American assumptions about what democracy will bring, that it has also produced a variety, not just of specific constitutional systems, but of political impulse. The early 21st century, for example, saw a wave of socialist victories in Latin American political elections. This didn't make these countries any the less democratic, but it meant that they were making democratic choices that differed from the preferences of United States leadership. The same thing may occur as democracy spreads to other parts of the world, particularly, for example, should it spread to the Middle East. The spread of democracy does not necessarily, in other words, erase the need to pay ongoing attention to global political complexity.
Lecture 34, Contemporary Cultural Change.
The contemporary period of world history has seen massive amounts of cultural change in most parts of the world. In this sense, the contemporary period might be compared to the post-classical period as a time in which large numbers of people rethought or were encouraged to rethink many aspects of their traditional beliefs. We can do the same thing for culture, at first at least, that we did for politics in our last discussion. If you look at the dominant cultural systems of most parts of the world around 1900, you would obviously emphasize the continued hold of the big world religions, plus Hinduism in India, plus Confucianism in many parts of East Asia. If one fast forwards a century later, the hold of the religions has been at least qualified. Confucianism has been profoundly challenged. The cultural map, quite simply, has become more complex. And again, this means that for whatever set of reasons, large numbers of people have rethought at least parts of what their parents or grandparents thought several decades earlier. But the story is, perhaps unfortunately, more complicated than the story we tried to tell for politics. In politics, we could argue that although there was no ultimate global agreement on a new political system, at least there was wide agreement that the old systems no longer worked. In culture, that turns out not to be the case. Perhaps until the 1970s, it looked like one or more of the new cultural systems would gain ascendancy and the old would really be pushed back. But revivals of religion, new religious dynamism makes it clear that we simply cannot call the new cultural scene, which means that although we deal with cultural change, we also deal with significant cultural contestation and competition among regions, but even more, within regions and often even within individuals, points to which we'll return at the end of the discussion. There were several reasons to see the contemporary period in terms of cultural change. New migration patterns ultimately could encourage cultural change because migration now increasingly brought people from one cultural zone to a very different zone. And in that encounter, they might change or modify their earlier beliefs. And if they went home again, either permanently or on vacation, they would bring seeds of cultural change with them in turn. Massive urbanization, and it is really important to remember that underpinning the contemporary period in world history has been a massive movement of people from countryside to city. Massive urbanization tore people from familiar cultural as well as social contexts and could leave them open to new kinds of loyalties. Active missionary efforts, if that's not a misplaced term, saw people vigorously pushing one or more of the new beliefs. A subset of this obviously involves the great revolutions of the contemporary period. Each of the revolutions systematically attacked older cultural systems, religion or Confucianism, in favor of some new or new combination of commitments. Lots of people were encouraged, pushed, or even forced to rethink their older cultural underpinnings. There were three main new competitors for cultural allegiance. None of the three systems was actually entirely new. Origins go back at least to the 19th century, maybe even to the 18th. But it was in the contemporary period that these systems began to win larger mass followings and began, therefore, to contest more fully some of the older belief packages. The first entrant was nationalism. Nationalism, as we discussed earlier, could combine with older belief systems because nationalism always praised tradition to some extent. Nationalists might even embrace older religious values as part of the traditional lexicon. But nationalism tended to move people at least partially away from older religious formulations, and it might encourage them to move away more substantially. Indian nationalism, for example, in the personification of leaders like Gandhi, urged Indians possibly to retain their older commitments to Hinduism or Islam, but to modify these by new views about social caste and class, by new views about gender, by new views about politics. This was not a frontal attack on older beliefs, but it encouraged some real modification. African nationalism was even more committed to cultural change. African nationalists had to attack, either directly or indirectly, some of the older polytheistic religious loyalties because they seemed backward, because they introduced new kinds, important kinds of social and political divisions, for example, into tribal units. For a variety of reasons, African nationalists, in urging people to gain a new sense of loyalty to their nation and state, African nationalists really worked hard to undercut or modify traditional religious loyalties. Source one, then, of cultural change involved the spread of nationalism, particularly in Africa and Asia, and the extent to which nationalist beliefs could give people new loyalties alongside of, or in some cases instead of, their older ones. The most systematic competitor for cultural allegiance in the 20th century was, of course, Marxism. Marxism has been dubbed the equivalent of religion, the gospel according to St. Marx, and it has many religious-like qualities, particularly in the hands of Marxist leaders in the 20th century. Thus, Marxism argues that religion is explicitly wrong, religion is an instrument of class oppression, and people should be encouraged to free themselves of it as preparation for the Marxist Revolution and then the glorious society that will come in the future. Marxism urged attention to scientific principles of history and to science itself. It urged a commitment to materialism and the material forces that, in Marx's view, drove the historical process. It urged commitment to principles of social equality, to new kinds of political formulations, and again, in the hands of actual Marxist leaders in the 20th century, it produced not only beliefs but also rituals deliberately designed to compete with older religious forms. So there were new holidays, new parades, new martyrs, new symbols that could really supplant religion in the eyes of many Marxist faithful, not only in the societies that went communist, but in societies, for example, in parts of Western Europe, where communist movements gained a strong hold. The third competitor for belief in the contemporary period in world history, doesn't actually have as tidy a label, but it is probably ultimately the most important of the three. Some anthropologists have dubbed this third new cultural commitment liberal humanitarianism. I don't insist on the term, but we need some label for it, and I'll stick to that for the moment. Liberal humanitarianism, as it spread in many parts of the West, in Japan, and elsewhere, liberal humanitarianism, it seems to me, emphasized at least three principal kinds of identity or intellectual commitment. The first was to consumerism. Consumerism is a cultural system that urges that people gain part of their satisfaction and part of their personal and group identity from the process of consuming new kinds of goods that they don't, strictly speaking, need from the standpoint of material survival, but which bring them pleasure, and pleasure is an important component of this new consumerist package, including often sexual pleasure. So consumerism could give people a new set of goals, a new set of identities that could powerfully compete with older identities as well. But consumerism isn't the only part of this package, which is why I don't want to use that term alone. It's too narrow. Liberal humanitarianism also involved a substantial commitment to science as a means of explaining the world around us, as a means frequently, when transmuted into social science, of also explaining social systems, and as the potential solution for many kinds of social and individual ills. Liberal humanitarianism thus urged, pretty obviously, that when a person got sick, the basic authority whom one should consult was an authority credentialed by science rather than by religion, magic, or some other mechanism. The third pillar of the liberal humanitarian approach is a considerable degree of tolerance and cosmopolitanism, a sense that there are things to learn from other people, there are different specific ways of doing things that could be tolerated. Liberal humanitarians pride themselves on openness to and interest in foreign ways and foreign goods. That can be part of consumerism. So it's a package defined by increasingly enthusiastic consumerism, increasing commitment to science as explanation and solution, and a considerable degree of tolerance and cosmopolitanism. These three systems, nationalism, Marxism, and liberal humanitarianism, obviously are not identical. So the first point to note is that as each challenged traditional beliefs, they also frequently challenged each other. Communists, strictly speaking, Marxists, were not supposed to be nationalists. Marx and Marxist leaders firmly combated nationalism as another cultural component that could mislead and misdirect the working classes. Nationalists were frequently hostile to consumerism. Consumerism is a more individualistic form of expression, and nationalists often looked to a more collective expression. So it's important to note that although all three of these systems could compete with older religious and philosophical beliefs, they certainly didn't agree with each other. But two points. First, they could and did, in fact, frequently combine. Most Marxists in World War I, there were a few exceptions, most Marxists ended up, for a combination of tactical and cultural reasons, actually embracing a certain degree of nationalism. Many Marxists down the line would also find themselves interested in consumerism, and even sometimes a certain amount of tolerance. Combinations are a common part of a process of cultural change, and that certainly applies here. Combinations also apply, of course, to the ways these systems could interact with older cultural values. The fact that these systems gained ground and did win many people away from traditional cultural allegiances shouldn't blind us to the fact that many people picked and chose and combined elements of these new systems with older elements as well. Thus, many Japanese consumerists, liberal humanitarians, in a society that was culturally increasingly secular, would nevertheless continue to use some Buddhist rituals for particular purposes, for example, funerals. Italian Marxists were sometimes notorious, male Italian Marxists, for sending their wives and children to church and baptism just in case. They didn't believe in religion, but maybe they needed a little bit of a safety net. So again, a combination was possible. the three new belief systems also finally did share some points in common. They were, first of all secular. Again, they might combine with some continued interest in religion, but strictly speaking, they all judged society and individual in terms of activities in this world, the success of the national state, the success of the proletarian movement and the communist system, the success of the individual in gaining new access to consumer goods, in displaying toleration, etc. They were all secular. They also were, although nationalism once in a while could challenge this, they also were, broadly speaking, progressive. That is, they believed that society over time would, or at least could, become better if the national state gained ground, as the communist revolution took hold, as standards of living rose so that people had greater consumer satisfactions. They looked to a certain degree of social progress, if not as inevitable, at least as desirable and possible. And they obviously, in both of these capacities, tended to pull attention away from the idea that the goal of the individual was to look for greater satisfaction after this life, for progress from this life to the next, rather than for progress within this world. And finally, although again nationalism could challenge this in some instances, for example, Nazism as a case in point, these systems, for the most part, were attached to some commitment to science. Science is most obviously part of the liberal humanitarian package, a belief that scientific research is an important key to the future, etc. But it's important to remember that Marxists also established great faith for science. Marx himself prided his theories on their scientific qualities. And most nationalists in practice, if only because they wanted to see increasing national strength, urged attention to science, increased emphasis on science education, etc., as well. In these qualities, secular, this world progressive, and scientific, in these qualities also, these systems tended to challenge the old. So, if we could stop here, we'd have a picture not entirely dissimilar to the picture we drew for politics the time before. For various reasons, people in a variety of societies became open to new beliefs. New beliefs were available in three different packages, which obviously had some relationship to political change as well. And these packages all challenged the old systems that were the primary identifiers culturally of the world in 1900. But two problems, although they add up to a fundamental statement. To date, the new systems, although they have gained ground and significantly complicated the cultural map, have not dislodged the older beliefs nearly as clearly as the new political systems have dislodged their older counterparts. Two problems. First of all, very simply, the picture we've drawn thus far does not entirely fit some key regions. Most notably, sub-Saharan Africa has to be defined in the contemporary period of world history thus far as a scene of massive cultural change. There's been a little bit of interest in Marxism, although this has been more a leadership than a mass interest, and no durable Marxist societies have been established. Some real interest in popular nationalism, although here too, more leadership interest than actual systematic mass conversions. Certainly some attraction to liberal humanitarianism as early as the 1920s. As novelists like Chinua Achebe have portrayed. Nigerian urbanites, for example, began to be converted to a new sense of the importance of improved living standards, new kinds of sexual expressions, etc., in such a way that they would defy older family and religious cultural traditions that, for example, urged people to give up their daily routines on occasion of the death of a close family member in order to go home and make sure that all the rituals and arrangements were taken care of. So the new belief systems, particularly consumerism, did gain ground, encouraged, among other things, by some exposure to new Western education systems. But the big cultural story in 20th century sub-Saharan Africa has been the massive gains –